Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Lunch and Learn this afternoon, which is focused today on the annual MLRO report. So, my name is Elaine Tai, and I head up the marketing for FSCom. And I'm delighted to introduce Fred McDowell, who's Senior Manager from our FinCrime team here today. So, Fred, he doesn't look it, but he has over 30 years' experience working in the banking sector and holding a number of senior AML roles within the banks. He was also MLRO for 8 years in a regulatory compliance function. And today, Fred's going to impart some of this experience in talking about how to present the MLRO report to senior management. So, look, first of all, for some housekeeping, reminding you all that the session is being recorded and will be available on demand from our website in the next few days. And look, please use this session to ask any questions you have in the chat area, and I'll pose them to Fred at the Q&A section later. So look, without further ado, across to you, Fred, and I'll see you later in the session.
Okay, thank you. I would just like to repeat the warm welcome given to everybody by Elaine. And thank everybody for taking time out of busy schedules today just to go through this webinar, trying to look at how you can get the maximum benefit out of your annual MLRO report. So one thing I would disagree with Elaine, I'm not 100% sure. I don't look like I've got 30 years experience, but anyway, there's only so much you can do with photography. What I'm going to try and do today is, from the years that I was an MLRO and also from undertaking some interim MLRO roles, I actually understand what it is just to kind of start from scratch and draft up an annual MLRO report. And also, with having done numerous now internal roles and the independent AML audits that we do, we review MLRO reports on a very regular basis. So what I'm going to try and do today is really combine those two experiences to give you share with you some information and tips maybe as to what I think are very important components to come up to your MLRO report. And that's the background. We'll try and make it practical and try and make it interactive with the questions and answers at the end. So again, thank you for your time, and we'll just get started. Okay, the goal is really today pretty self-explanatory really. It's really just to help MLROs get the most out of your annual MLRO report. Maybe move it a wee bit away from it's one of those tasks I have to do, must do, to actually a task that you want to do. To also increase the impact of the MLRO report, a lot of time and effort is put into it, and really to try and maximize that return on your time to give it the most impact that you can. And really, it is, I suppose, fundamentally, it's an assurance document, it's an assurance piece of work for your senior management. And today, when we talk about senior management, we'll probably really mean senior management, but also maybe your board, could be board members as well. So we'll just look at this one. Why do we actually have to do an MLRO report? This is the why. I've taken two sections out of here of the FCA handbook, where it actually records and says an appropriate provision of information to its governing body, and could be your board or whatever, senior management, including a report at least annually by your MLRO. When I was prepping for this, there's one word actually jumped out at me that I actually hadn't seen before, and it's the word including. So sometimes we very often kind of think of the MLRO report as a kind of a standalone document. But really, it's where we say there, and the requirement is to provide appropriate provision of information to their governing body, including. So it really infers that the MLRO report is not the only time you do this. And most firms should have, in their compliance function or as an MLRO, you would have the opportunity to report up to seniors maybe on a monthly basis, maybe on a quarterly basis. So the MLRO report is not a standalone document. It really should be kind of the wrap-up at the end of the 12-month reporting period. There shouldn't be any surprises. If I was on your senior board and all of a sudden I'm finding out that we have a massive gap in our transaction monitoring system, and I'm only finding that out in the MLRO report, then somewhere in between that we've missed an opportunity to share that. So it's quite important. The MLRO report is very much a kind of summary document at the end. I suppose when we think about other stakeholders within our organisations, if we think of other functions like finance, finance will very often report to senior management. They'll provide budgets, planning, management accounts, draft accounts, annual accounts. You know, the sales function will come forward with regular reports of performance against revenue targets, etc. HR will come forward with staffing updates, vacancy updates. And really, compliance should really have a regular reporting vehicle in the senior management. It shouldn't be ad hoc, it shouldn't be just every now and again. But you know, compliance as a function is just as critical to firms as those other functions are. So really, we should be reporting on a regular basis. Use the report wisely. Okay, this is your opportunity, really, as MLROs. I'm assuming that most of the people on the webinar today are active MLROs or maybe MLROs who are deputizing as well. So it's an opportunity to communicate to your senior management how the firm's systems and controls, and the important word here is protect the firm. Sometimes compliance can have the perception that it's a barrier to doing business. It's a barrier to get round to do business. But very much the controls that you have in place within your firm, they're there to protect the firm. Fundamentally, they're there to protect the firm. And in that, they're also there to protect staff, shareholders, senior management board. And that's an important kind of part of the tone in your MRO report, is to reflect that. These are controls to protect the firm. No two firms' MRO reports should ever look identical. So sometimes it's hard to share a specific template as such. Because your own report has to look and feel like your firm. The size of your firm, the complexity of it, the complexity and range of the products. You could be a firm that's been up and running for 18 months, you could be a firm that's been running for 8 years. The compliance culture within the firm, all those variables will impact what your report looks like, and that's very appropriate too. This slide is probably, it's actually slightly busy, but what I've tried to capture here is effectively, I suppose, 13 headings that I think would be sections that you'd want to include in an MLRO report, what a good MLRO report would look like. And they're self-explanatory there, and we'll go through them in a bit more detail in a few minutes. They're not compulsory, they're not mandatory. Your firm may pick and choose. There may be, for example, bullet point 10 there is outsourcing arrangements. If your firm had no outsourcing arrangements, obviously you don't need to have that in your MRO report. So there may be ones that you put a lot of detail into, there may be other ones where it's a slightly lighter touch. But ultimately these 13, I think, from being an MRO and also doing audits where we see the MRO report is one of the key documents we review when we do an audit. Having read through them, I think these 13 are a pretty good starting point from where you would look to draft your MRO report. Okay, the first few are relatively straightforward. This one is really is quite self-explanatory. It's a short section. You want to record the date of incorporation, the number of employees, where the business is located, and there may be new geographies added in recently that you haven't done before. And one thing here you mightn't be expecting to see is to actually state the firm's risk appetite. What we've seen sometimes is very, very rarely does the actual firm and document its risk appetite. And within the MRO report, this isn't a bad place to put that in. If you think about it logically, if your report's trying to give assurance to your senior management, to your board, and the firm can't articulate or doesn't document what its risk appetite to AML and CTF risk is, then it's hard to give them assurance. So it's probably more by exception that this is documented, but if you have a risk appetite statement, it's no bad thing to put it in. If you will, we'll touch on a few other pieces later on in the webinar, but if you're thinking about your whole firm risk assessment, how do you draft up your whole firm risk assessment if you don't know what the firm's risk appetite is? So in this section, if you don't have it, it's not a bad thing to consider putting it in. It adds a bit of detail, and also it actually records, it's a record that as the MRO and then the compliance function, you understand what the firm's risk appetite is and it has been decided and formally approved. The regulatory framework section, again, this will be very easy to populate. You know, firm X, you're an authorized API, what date you're authorized on, You're regulated by the FCA again, what data you regulate. And then I would actually take a few moments just to record and document the actual legal and the regulatory legislation that applies to you. Also, I think it's very worthwhile putting in that you've adopted the GMLSG and any other guidance points. So again, if we think about the audience here, your senior management are going to get reports in from many, many functions within the firm, depending upon the complexity of the firm. But they will be getting information from many different directions. And because we're compliance experts, very often we'll assume that they understand or they know all the legislation that we have to comply with and all the guidance and documents that we refer to. That may be the case, but it's no harm just to take a few lines here and actually formally record and those different sections. Once you've recorded those, it automatically means you have to make some comment against them. You know, if you haven't complied with them, if you've maybe had a breach or something, it's worth recording here as well. If you've recorded that maybe you've breached some piece of legislation, also you can record what you've done to fix that gap too. The other thing, I think too, when I was drafting this, I tried to put myself in the shoes of senior management. So I'm wanting you to give me assurance how my firm's doing. And the other thing I want to know is, you know, what is the future like? And a brief commentary here on what I think or what the MRO thinks the regulatory landscape is, what's on the horizon is also very important. Because it gives me some sense, are things stable? Are we going to go into a period where, in terms of AML and CTF, there's an awful lot going to happen in the next 12 months. If you think back to maybe a lot of years ago when the risk-based approach was introduced, that massively changed the landscape in terms of AML and CTF. That would be the type of thing that you'd want to include, something of that kind of materiality. It would be good for your senior management to appreciate what's coming down the tracks in the next 12 months. The MRO details. Again, you might think this is very, very basic, very kind of what you'd expect. The name of the MRO, the date that you were approved by the board to have that appointment. The reason why you also put this in is probably actually more importantly the second bullet point here. You're clarifying what your responsibilities are as MRO and also what they may not be. So not in every firm is the MRO the person who has ultimate responsibility or accountability for AML and CTF risk. It may well sit with a director, may well sit maybe with a chief risk officer. If that's the case, I think it's worthwhile putting it in your report. Again, it's giving people that insight and visibility that yes, you are the MRO, but ultimately this risk sits with the chief risk officer. Most firms, the MRO will be the person who actually submits SARs into the NCA, will do the nominated officer role. But sometimes in firms, you're not actually that person. So again, if you're not the nominated officer, it's well worthwhile putting in who is a nominated officer and their role. So really you're just clarifying, you're giving a very clear picture, good visibility of what your roles and responsibilities are as an MRO. Sometimes in the report, it's hard to always want to maybe put in things that in the report are going to be deemed negative. And this is probably one section here under resources and access. If you have not had the resources, for example, to do your role fully, then I think it is appropriate that the report should reflect that. Very often when we do the audits, the way we, when we do the scope design with clients at the start, the one thing we would always say is, one of the asset tests for us doing a good job is that we give you an accurate report. No compliance officer, no MRO wants to have a bad report. No one wants to have 4, 5, 6 findings, whatever the number would be. But that's really not what people are employing us to do to an independent audit. They want an accurate report. And I would use that same kind of mantra for your MRO report. There's no pleasure writing things in the report like, I don't have enough resources to do the role, or maybe our systems are aged and they're not up to scale compared to where the firm is now. But if that's the accurate position of the firm, then I think you have a duty to put it in the report. The report has to be balanced. So all the good things that you do as an MRO and the compliance function does as a team very much should have visibility. But where there are maybe gaps or where there's opportunities for improvement, our systems need to be strengthened or revised, then it's relevant to put those in. So sometimes in this section, it's good practice to put in where there may be gaps. The other thing I think is worth noting here is also competency. Many years ago, the compliance function were their skill level may not have been, the expectation may be that the skill level would not have been as high as it is now. But really the team now are subject matter experts, such as the complexity of all the different aspects they deal with. So it's very, very important, I think, that you put in a comment here about the competency of the team. You know that they're there, you know the team's not full of people who are only in the job 2 months. You give some sense, some assurance across to your senior management that your team in there are people who are well experienced and they have the ability and the competency to undertake the roles that they're doing within the compliance function. Your governance structure, a few lines here, again, I think it's worthwhile. As MLROs, you'll be very familiar maybe with the three lines of defence model. Your senior management board may hear about it, but don't maybe understand what it actually means for you. So again, a brief section here, making it very clear that as the MLRO and the compliance function, you're second line of defence. Have there been any factors that you've experienced in the last 12 months maybe that would have restricted your effectiveness within that model? So maybe giving an example, let's say the quality of the periodic reviews that you get to look at where there's maybe enhanced due diligence and you're reviewing those and signing those up. Maybe they come in a very, very poor state. Maybe the first line is very inexperienced, so they're coming through to you in a pretty poor condition. So your team, as a second line team, are effectively having to fix those records. You're probably having to almost, you're defaulting to almost being a QA function. So then in reality, you're not really doing a pure second line. Your role is that you're redoing those records. So when you come to review them, to some extent, you're almost reviewing your own work. If that was a typical scenario, that's the type of comment that you might summarize in, have there been any factors that have restricted your effectiveness? Again, it's not seen in a negative way. It's just seen as being very accurate and very honest. And you're just, suppose, communicating any of the restrictions within the current governance model. Okay, these next few slides then are a wee bit meatier. They're a wee bit more maybe what you'd expect to see. So those earlier slides are very much in the background. You're setting the tone. Always think of your audience. You know, there's lots of things you'll know about your role. There's lots of things you know about the compliance function that the audience may not have that proximity to. So again, you know, take the opportunity to make it very, very clear. Your AML CTF policies, okay, very important. The kind of detail I think you should be putting in here is when were they last reviewed, and when were they approved, and what were the key changes in any of your AML policy, CTF policy over the last reporting period, and what precipitated that change. It may have been maybe a new money laundering directive came into force and you had to revise your policy and procedures. Maybe the firm diversified and took on new products or went into different geographies. Give that kind of context to why the policies have changed. Again, I think it's worthwhile. If you get the opportunity, you can add that you think they're now stable or that you foresee another major shift being required in the next 12 months because you know there's another fresh money laundering directive going to come into force or some new legislation is going to come in. So again, it's one that you're giving assurance and as a senior management team, they'll be keen to know, right, okay, are things stable or things a change? Is it going to be a big change or a small change? One of the most critical sections, I think, and one of the most critical things that you will do in your compliance function is your whole firm risk assessment. And this is a section within the MLR report has huge value. It's a very critical section. You'll know yourself from completing these that we basically start off with the AML policy. And a very granular review of that's done, it'll drive out what you assess to be the AML and CTF risks for your firm. You'll start off with the inherent risk. You'll maybe score it some way in a numeric fashion. The most common was most people will do a form of RAG status on it. And then they'll design controls to bring those risks down to the level, the residual risk level, which they're comfortable with. Out of that, they'll normally develop some of their key risk indicators and they'll share those with the senior management. So this is a critical section here. You know, you should be telling your senior manager when the whole firm risk assessment was last reviewed, if there's been any new risk added on, why they're added on, what controls you have in place. So again, it's a very good way of giving assurance that your report is bang up to date. If you haven't reviewed it, it's probably one of the key documents that should be reviewed on a very regular basis. Sometimes that will be triggered during the year because there's been an incident, but at least on an annual basis, your whole firm risk assessment should be reviewed. What it then lines up to very much to is if we go back to your risk appetite statement. So if your firm has a risk appetite statement where they say they have a very, very low risk tolerance to AML and CTF risk, and your residual risks, you have a number of those sitting in an amber color, that doesn't actually align. So if this is where your risk appetite statement and your whole firm risk assessment should align up, and that's why it's an important thing to consider, you know, what exactly is the risk appetite of the firm. Coming out of that whole firm risk assessment, then you're going to have a compliance monitoring plan. And again, this would be an important section within your MRO report. A lot of time and effort will be put into controls, designing those controls, looking at how often they're applied, are they monthly, quarterly, whatever. But even no matter how valuable the controls are that your compliance monitoring plan and your whole firm risk assessment have triggered, if you're not testing those, then potentially they're fundamentally flawed. So again, a very important section within your MRO report is to comment on how has the compliance monitoring testing gone? How often was it done throughout the year? Did it pass every time? Were there any gaps, any deficiencies? Were there any areas highlighted where the control actually wasn't been implemented correctly? Whether some new controls had to be designed in the year because you had maybe a few near misses or you had some sort of compliance breach. But again, I think it's a very, very important part of the report. These are probably the key assurance elements that the board is going to read or your senior management are going to read in most detail. Audits. Everybody loves getting audits. They're a real fun part of life in compliance. You can have them externally and you can have them internally. But again, you'd want to state, okay, we've had one external audit this year, we've had two internal audits, what areas were tested. You'd want to share the scope of those audits. You'd want to give a high level, you know, whether it was a good audit, you know, whether it was a pass, a clear pass, whether it was marginal, etc. And also I think then the findings, you'd want to summarize the findings. So as your senior manager team, get a sense of what findings come out of those audits, whether they're external or internal. For the findings, you probably also want to give some degree of detail as to what actions have come out of those findings. Have you changed some controls? Have you implemented new controls, etc., to give peace of mind that the findings that were highlighted in the audit processes, that you've actually taken those on board and that corrections have been put in place. The last thing then is thematic reviews. Thematic reviews probably in the pecking order of audits probably come last, but I think this is where I think very often as a compliance function, we can miss a trick here. They're regularly undervalued and they're actually probably your best opportunity of showing proactiveness. So let's say, for example, halfway through the year, there was a major press release detailing how offshore trusts can be used and potentially be used for maybe facilitating money laundering, which sounds kind of quite topical at the moment. But maybe then in your thematic review section of your MRO report, you'd want to show your proactiveness here that you saw that risk, you identified the risk, you took it on board, you looked at your client base. For example, maybe you were able to identify 12 clients who had offshore trust within their ownership structures. You reviewed them, 10 of them were fine, two of them you had some concern about. With a bit more due diligence and a bit of correspondence with clients, you were able to give yourself assurance in those two. And overall, what you can give assurance to your senior manager is that you spotted that risk, you're managing it, you've done your own thematic review, and at the end of it, you're now content that your firm does not have that exposure. So it's slightly different than the audits. The audits maybe are not so much proactive, but thematic reviews are actually a very, very good way of you being proactive and showing that evidence of your proactiveness around managing risk. Ultimately, in this section, I think you have to give some sort of conclusion. Are we effective? Do we need enhancement? Do we need additional controls? Customer due diligence won't really surprise you. It has been one of the sections I think needs to be included in the MRO report. What I would like to know if I was senior management is what is our risk profile like? You know, what's our percentage of clients who are high risk, medium risk, low risk? I think you have to put in comparative data here. It doesn't mean an awful lot to me if you tell me it's 12% this year because I don't know what it was last year. So again, I want to know the trends and the patterns. I want to know is our high-risk population increasing? Despite what were the reasons behind it? And again, if you see a change in some of these stats, it doesn't always mean there's an issue. Again, you need to put in a wee bit of detail here. You might find that your high-risk population is now 12%, last year it was 9%, and the reason might something be quite simple, like there's maybe a couple of companies have been identified now as high-risk jurisdictions that weren't high-risk jurisdictions 12 months ago. So you want to give that some that detail behind where you have maybe headline rates move. You want to be able to give that assurance to the audience that you understand why they have moved. Again, it may touch upon some of your key risk indicators here. So it's not a bad thing to bear those in mind. You may say we're above our key risk indicator, but it's actually outside of our control, these countries, and we're reviewing it. So again, you want to show that you've taken corrective action steps if you've gone above and outside any of your key risk indicators. I think it's appropriate to give commentary on your screening system, your CRM system. You know, are they fit for purpose? They may have been designed 2 or 3 years ago when the firm started off, but maybe now the firm's had a couple of years of really, really rapid growth. But some of these systems may not have been updated, may not have come along as well. So again, there's commentary in there. There's an opportunity to make valid comment on those. Periodic reviews. If you have overdue KYC reviews, or if you have maybe some of your alerts, it could be screening alerts, it could be your adverse media, whatever type of or transaction monitors. If you have overdue reviews, I think it's very worthwhile detailing these. Again, you want to give some trend analysis. You may have a fraction this time round compared to what you had last year. So again, give that kind of context. But one of the important things, and very, very rarely seems to go into any reports, is where there are overdue reviews, few firms seem to actually put any aging profile on them. And that's a very important thing. And what I've done is suggest there are a few categories. You may want to break them down as to how many are not to 7 days, 14, 14 to 31, 1 month, 2 months. Because all of a sudden you start to give a much more accurate impression to senior management. So if you have an awful lot of overdue reviews, but they're only not to 7 days, that's a very different picture than if you have a few not to 7 days and you've got numbers in the 30 to 60 category or the 60 days plus category. So again, that kind of detail will either give assurance or will raise and give visibility should you have issues in that regard. Reporting is the next section here. Then your MLRO report, you will have appendices in the very back kind of tail end of the report. You can put some detail in there, but in this actual section, you want to have the quality. You want to pick key AML management information. You don't want to give pages and pages and screen of data here. This is really about picking out the key ones to give that assurance, trends and patterns. How many new clients have they doubled? Maybe the proportion of your overdue period reviews, they've halved. How many high-risk relationships maybe you've exited, the key stuff that is relevant to ML and CTF risk. If you're in the unfortunate position maybe where you've had a breach, and also very importantly, near misses, because sometimes the near misses are just as important learning points as having breaches, record them. I think you want to put some materiality beside them. You may have had to advise a regulator, you may not have had to. What corrective action plans to put in place, and are those issues now addressed? Have you enhanced your controls to make sure they don't happen a second time? SARs, there's obviously a big element of confidentiality around SARs, but again, I think you'd want to detail how many internal SARs have you received. Is that an improvement from last year? Is it stable? Is it a decrease? How many were then maybe submitted on to the NCA? You may also, if you've had a number of DAML SARs, you may want to comment upon them also. Another interesting thing sometimes to put in your reporting section would be if you've had production orders or freezing orders served on the firm in the reporting period. And one of the interesting things there sometimes from an assurance exercise is to be able to go back and say, well, we had 3 production orders served on us in the last 12 months. Of those 3 production orders, we actually served all those clients already, or we hadn't. So again, you're giving some context and background to the production orders. The AML then and the CTF training, very important. quick few lines about your policy. You know, everybody gets training, it's done annually. It's maybe launched in March of every year and people are given 60 days to complete it. People maybe who have been off and long-term sick have to do it before they come back into the firm. People who are on board throughout the year as new starts do it within their first month. State all that's good stuff for the senior management to understand. Also then you can put in a section on the competency. Most firms nowadays don't just have computer-based training that you can flick through and go through. Normally there's competency-based assessment throughout it. Again, it's a good to put in there. It gives people comfort how many people are passing the test. I also think then that there's value in maybe differentiating the generic training that goes across all the functions. So you have your HR team, your marketing, et cetera, but also then detailing what subject matter expert training has been given to the compliance team. And also if you've had people in your team who have maybe got their ICA diploma this year or taken professional qualifications, I think it's a great call to give them a shout. Again, it's giving that perception, it's giving people assurance that the people within your compliance team are taking those opportunities and getting professional qualifications to be stronger in their roles. So the last couple of sections then we come to, and this one is really outsourcing. If it's one of the ones, maybe it's more optional, it may not apply to everybody. But if you have reliance on outsourcing, again, I think brief commentary on has it been effective? Have the SLAs been respected, et cetera? Is there any risk in that? Are you too reliant on it? Do you want to consider bringing that in-house, et cetera? And again, a brief section on your any specific AML and CTF projects. This would be more major ones. Are they on plan? You know, if you were given approval to look at maybe investment in a new CRM system, I would detail that. Is it on plan? Is it on plan to be launched? Has it been its integration working smoothly? Is it on budget? If you have corrective action plans in place, sometimes known as CAPs, they may have come out of audits, they may have been self-identified. Again, a section there just saying that over the 12 months we have had 4 corrective action plans, 3 are closed off or closed off in time, 1 is open and is due to be closed off, you know, in the next 2 months or whatever. But again, these are all important pieces that paint the kind of the fabric or the frame of all the different aspects of risk that you're going to manage as an MLRO and within a compliance function, and all things that your senior management team should be aware of. So you come to the last section, which is probably one of the most critical ones, because some people may go straight to this and read the summary bit. I think you have to have a conclusion here. So what you've done in the earlier sections has lots of different threads where you've evidenced risk, how it's been well managed, how the firm's been protected. You've called it very accurately. If there's gaps, any deficiencies, you've highlighted those so the report is accurate, it's reliable. You have maybe picked out key highlights here. You maybe again just reiterate, refresh some of the key risks. You know, give the senior management team a real clear picture. You know, is the risk environment that the firm's working within, is it stable? Is it increasing? Is it reducing? I suppose ultimately, is the firm in a better position than they were at the last report? And also maybe a few lines on what new risks they might expect to see over the next 12 months. I also think it's very worthwhile to very clearly call out and record formally what your recommendations are, because your MRO report should be accepted by your board. And again, I think here they should realize if there are recommendations there that you're asking them to approve, make it formal, make it very visible and detail the recommendations that you're actually asking them to accept and approve. By its very nature, the MLRO report is going to be quite wordy. You may have certain sections in there where you can put some sort of statistics and which break it a wee bit, but it's going to be quite a wordy document. And I suppose me personally, I like visuals. So if I read through all the context, this table here in many ways actually sums it up really, really, really well. If I was a member of your senior management, I can go to this table. I can see the areas. I can see that they were green last year. They're green this year. I can see last year as a firm, we had 3 ambers. We've now got 2. So in theory, we're in a better position. I can see that 2 of my ambers from last year are now green. That's great. And I've got 1 fresh amber in the KRIs. And something I may dig into more detail is the fact that staff training is still showing as amber. So this is a visual slide, is very important. The other thing I would suggest on the practical side is where you maybe have recommendations, attach them to each area. So again, the board is very, very clear. Obviously, you'd naturally expect them maybe to be recommendations around where you have ambers or you would have reds. But it's a very quick and easy way to see the improvement, or if the position's reversed and actually things are slightly worse than they were 12 months ago, to see that in a pictorial sense. The last section then is just very, very short and sweet. It's basically a bit of record keeping. I think you'd want to date your report, obviously, the date it was submitted to the board, formally record that. Also formally record if the recommendations were approved, and you should have a minute of this, and that the board actually accept your MLR report and endorse and agree to the recommendations, or if there's elements of investment you're seeking. And so it's ultimately the acid test. After you've spent your time doing this, you know, is there a very clear sense where the controls are working? You know, can a third party come to this and clearly see the risks? Is the risk profiling increasing or decreasing? Is it clear where the stakeholders have accountability? And ultimately, you want the board or your senior manager to have confidence that what they have in front of them is a good report, in the sense that it's robust and it's honest and it's accurate. And there may be things in it that ideally they don't want to read, maybe where there's been gaps or deficiencies, but ultimately it's a bit like our independent audits. We don't go looking for findings, but if there's findings there, we should find them. That's what people pay us a fee to do. And the MLRO report effectively is very, very similar. It needs to be accurate. It doesn't need to be biased one way or the other. It needs to acknowledge all the good work that the MLRO and the compliance team do. But if there's been gaps or learning points, it should also record those also. And that's what will give your senior management assurance that what they've got in front of them is a document that they can rely upon. So that really is everything from running through a report. Thank you for your patience going through that. And I think now, if we have time, I think we're able to take some questions and answers. Hopefully you find that useful, and hopefully some of the narrative behind it gives some context to sections.
Great, Fred. Thank you so much. Okay, so we have had quite a few questions in, so lots of engagement, which is great. So let's kick off then with the first one. You mentioned there, Fred, that detailing gaps and deficiencies in the firm's control framework is important. Surely this lands badly with senior management. How best can that be managed?
I think ideally, I suppose every MLRO wants to give a report that's glowing, that says there's no gaps, there's no deficiencies, everything's good, and there's been no kind of breaches, there's been no near misses, there's no overdue reviews. But in reality, most firms don't, you know, are not actually able to say that, or quite a few firms won't be able to say that. So again, I think it comes back to there's an old American kind of analogy about the squeaky wheel gets the oil. And basically, if you have, for example, you know, and one that would quite regularly come through when we do audits, Liam, would be that, you know, firms from a resourcing perspective, there's more and more compliance than put on firms. Therefore, very often the resourcing is strained and stretched, and it's kind of trying to prioritize that. So quite a few firms will have shortfalls. And that should come through in the report. You know, if you've got overdue reviews, and that may be one of the evidences to suggest that there's a resourcing issue. But putting that in report, that's accurate. If it's not recorded and you kind of maybe gloss over it, it's a bit awkward putting in the report. The danger is then your senior management don't know you've got an issue. And from my experience, most senior manager teams and boards, they want to know the issues. You know, they're the ones sitting accountable for this. They want to know you've got shortfalls in resourcing and skill levels or whatever. And most of them will try and support you. So again, I think, I think you should record everything. It needs to be accurate. It might look the prettiest, but at least people have confidence that it is an accurate assessment of the MLRO's report on the firm's control environment for that reporting period.
Okay, great. Thank you, Fred. Okay, next question then. Would you feel that a quarterly MLRO report would suffice instead of an annual MLRO report?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think not every firm will want to do a quarterly report, but I think there are certain firms where it might be appropriate. So if your firm is maybe in the process of going through a huge amount of change, it could be system change, it could be taking on a whole lot of different products, or maybe just the fact that, you know, the scale has been great and the revenue streams have been huge and it's just really scaling up. There are times where I think a quarterly report would be very, very prudent, for two reasons. First of all, it gives the visibility to senior management quicker than waiting for an annual report. So if you've got issues, a quarterly report can kind of meet that angle. But also it helps greatly when you come to do the annual report, that actually you will be 75% of the way there almost when you come into that kind of last quarter. I don't think quarterly reports should replace the annual report. I still think it's a very worthwhile exercise to look back over 12 months and to look forward for 12 months. I think also you kind of maybe, the danger of just doing it quarterly is you may not always have kind of one eye on what's coming at you in some sense too. But yeah, I think there will be occasions where firms should probably think that a formal quarterly report would be a prudent thing to do. It may be as they go through, as I say, maybe massive change. It wouldn't have to be every year, but there may be cycles in their journey where quarterly reporting would be very good.
Okay, thanks, Fred. And again, I suppose continuing the same thread of the annual versus the quarterly, someone has asked, if the annual report is not supposed to contain any surprises and it is merely a summary of the regular reports already made during the year, what value does it actually add in practice? So I suppose what they're asking there is, you know, why would you do the annual if you're already doing the quarterly? What does it actually add?
Well, I don't, you know, it's a difficult one. I still think there's a requirement. It says there, you know, in the FCA handbook, it says at least on an annual basis. The danger maybe on a quarterly report is that you will not differentiate. It's not as easy to see the trends. So if you do quarter to quarter, people will be a lot closer to it, so they may not actually be able to see the journey over the 12 months. Also, I would kind of guess that most quarterly ones don't always have that comparative. They don't compare previous quarters, you know, what last year's report was like, what the future might be like. I think it's going to come down to personal choice. I still think there's validity and value in having an annual one. Maybe you don't have to do it the same degree of detail. Maybe it would be more like a kind of executive summary in some sense. But I still think one of the big pieces you'll miss out of a quarterly MRO report is that look forward and kind of predicting what's coming down the track.
Okay, great. Fred, another question then around the MRO report and the length of time. So yeah, in your experience, how long do you consider the MRO report should take to draft from start to final copy?
That's a good question. I suppose it really depends. It'll depend on the size and the complexity of the business. If you're a relatively new start and you have maybe one or two specific products, your MRO report shouldn't be onerous. If you've been established for 8 or 9 years and you have a range of products and you deal in a range of geographies, and you're a much, much larger firm, maybe employing 70, 80 or 100 plus people, it'll take more time. One of the values, that maybe goes back to the earlier questions, Elaine, is one of the values of doing regular reporting, maybe not technically or formally under the title of an MRO report, but doing monthly and quarterly briefings to senior management. If those are done with, I suppose, one eye looking on the year-end MRO report, that can make the process far, far easier. And we've seen some firms when we've done audits who really have a very, very light touch reporting month by month, quarter by quarter. And then when they come to do their MRO report, they really are probably starting from scratch to some degree. We've seen other firms that have good structured monthly information packs that go up to their board, up to their senior management. They have a risk committee. So between different forms like that, when it comes to write the report, it's maybe a wee bit easier, a wee bit less onerous because they have a lot of the content already available and it's more writing the report as opposed to starting from scratch and kind of think, okay, well, what have we done over the last 12 months? So it will vary. There's no right or wrong answer. I've seen MRO reports that are 6 or 7 pages long. I have seen MRO reports that are, you know, 20 pages long. I think you want to go for for quality. Ultimately, it is a piece of work that is assurance you're trying to convey and communicate, give visibility to your senior management how the firm is positioned, and that's really what should drive the report. You don't want pages and pages of narrative. It doesn't need to be too wordy. It should be a report.
Okay, thank you, Fred. Okay, another one here then. So you suggest including key AML stats and including comparative data. Is that likely to distract from the key messages being made?
No, I don't think so. I think in actual report, in the body of the report itself, you want to be quite clever in how you use the stats. So I'll give you an example. Quite a lot of firms will have overdue reviews. As I said earlier, maybe it's periodic reviews, maybe it's, you know, the likes of transaction monitoring alerts, whatever. If in their report they just say we have 50 overdue reviews, without giving it some sort of context, that can sound alarming to senior management who don't know the context of that. If, for example, your 50 overdue reviews, if you put that aging profile that we talked about in one of the slides, if you had 40 of those 50 was in the 0-7 category, and you had maybe 8 in the next aging kind of bucket, and you had 2 at the 14-31 days, that's one scenario. If you had maybe only 20 in the 0-7 category, and you had some in the 30-60 category, and maybe 6 or 7 in the 60 days plus category, that's a very, very different story. And I think that's the value of actually giving those comparative figures and putting that kind of context, because then senior management will look at that and they will see a very different. So if they just see a headline rate of 50 overdue reviews without sort of saying some comparative data or a breakdown in terms of age profiling, it's that comparative data and the age profiling that actually let them see, well, okay, what's the risk? Well, actually, with very little risk, because nearly all our overdue reviews are less than a week. Or, hold on, actually, we have a big risk because we have half of them are more than a month old, and what's going on. So I think that that's where it adds value in that kind of scenario.
Okay, thank you, Fred. Okay, so this is another question here then. As a new incoming MLRO who is not in place for the full year, should I signal this in the report, or should I analyse my predecessor's tenure? So this is from a new incoming MLRO who wasn't in place for the full year. Should that person signal it in their report?
Yes, I think that's a valid inclusion. I think, you know, if somebody has come in maybe halfway through a reporting period, I think at the very early stage, maybe around the MLRO details section, that's the type of thing they would say. So if I'm reporting on the period 2021, but I only came into position on the 1st of July, then I think it's a relative comment to make that in terms of my appointment to that role and within the firm, that my appointment started on the 1st of July.
Okay, great. Should I make reference in my commentary to the culture towards compliance in my report? Yes. So should you make reference to the culture towards compliance?
It's not a good question. But I think to some degree the outputs in the report will, you know, a third party coming along reading the report will probably get a fair idea of the culture within the firm as they go through the report. And what I mean by that is if as they've gone through the report and read it and they see that everything's well managed, the report's very honest, very accurate, there's been issues, but they've been quickly closed, there's no resourcing issues, the training program's strong. If all those different components that make up the report are all reading positively, I think you have a right to naturally assume there's a positive culture. If you go through a report and there's maybe the trends are maybe trends that are deteriorating, you know, and there's been slippage in reviews and the position's kind of getting a bit hardcore and there's no real improvement in overdue reviews, the resourcing still seems to be an issue. If you think of the simple table, if there was 2 ambers last year and there's now 4 ambers this year and 1 red, if all those kind of trends are all trending you know, in the wrong direction, then it's probably, unless there's some very, very strong mitigants, then there's probably a fair, it's a fair thing to assume that the culture of compliance in the firm's not strong. I think it can be down to a whole lot of things. It's very hard to say that it should be a formal statement around culture. It could just be with the best endeavors in the world, and it's been a very hard 12 months. So I personally don't think you'd make a statement around culture. I think as people, if the report is prepared and drafted and gives a really accurate impression of the firm, I think the culture within the firm will come out of the report itself.
Okay, thanks, Fred. If you are a smaller startup company with a less established compliance team and plan, can you produce a condensed MLRO report with key topics? And if so, what are they?
I don't think you can prepare or draft a condensed. I think what we've tried to supply today is a kind of framework. I think if you have a young team and you're new to the role, you can still use the framework that we've kind of suggested today. You may tailor that to your firm. So if you take some of the bigger firms that maybe are very well established and running for maybe 5 or 10 years, their MLRO report will be more detailed, will be more complex. It'll have maybe the sections will be more fully filled out. If you're a young firm and you don't have that depth experience, then your report naturally will be lighter. I've seen some very good MLRO reports that have been 4 or 5 pages, but there've maybe been ones where the firm is relatively small and they've a very niche market. They don't want to have massive growth. They're very happy doing what they do, and the report is proportional to its size. So I wouldn't fill out the report to make it a certain size. I still think most of the sections that we've referred to are probably going to be relevant. It's really what depth of detail you're going to put into them. So I think you can condense it by the fact that, you know, there's no point padding it out to be a big document. But on the other hand, I think the sections that we've highlighted, the other thing I looked at is there's a template on the JMLSG site, and I kind of compared the template that we have drafted internally here, which we've shared with some clients at different times, that we've looked at that template and with the one in the JMLSG, and they're very, very comparable. So it's not as if there's things we have added on to make it a lengthy document. The two documents are actually quite similar.
Okay, Fred, you'd be glad to hear. I think that's the final question. Well, there are a couple of others there, but they're quite repetitive of what we've already covered. So just talking about detailed granular reports and how you balance that against expectations. But I think you've covered that already when you've talked about your summary and how you visually represent that to board. So look, Fred, thank you so much for that very, and we've already received a lot of excellent feedback in the comments and everybody asking for the recording. So the recording will be sent out tomorrow via email, along with a certificate of attendance. And it'll also be available on our website in the coming days. So for anybody that missed part of it or had to jump off, you'll get to see it again. So look, thank you, Fred. Is there anything else left from yourself to say, or will I just go to close?
Well, the only thing, May, is just, Elaine, it's I have a draft kind of template that we've used several times, maybe when we've been doing audits with clients and to help them, when we've maybe been looking over MLRO reports. What I'm going to try and do maybe is build that out slightly and maybe put some of the commentary that we've covered on today's session, and maybe we can make that available if any of the firms who joined us in the webinar, if they're interested, if they want to maybe drop us an email, we can get that out to them maybe in due course in the future if it was helpful.
Okay, great. Well, the promise is there. So I'll send out an email to that effect and let everybody know how they can go about inquiring about that template. So Fred, thank you so much again. I think everybody found that really, really useful. And just to let everybody know that the next webinar will be on operational resilience on Thursday, 14th, same time, same place, with Nick Gumbley from our cybersecurity team and Nick Wright from our payments and Alison Donnelly. So look, thank you everyone. Enjoy the rest of your day and we'll see you all soon. Take care.
Thank you very much. Bye.